Welcome to the Science Podcast for August 2nd, 2013. I'm Christy Hamilton.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, we bring you four interviews with contributors to our special issue on natural systems in changing climates. We discuss patterns of ecosystem change under past climate shifts, predicting the movement of infectious disease under climate change, the potential for migrating marshes, and ramping up from icebox oceans to a hot tub planet.
So back in the greenhouse world, surface water temperatures were closer to a hot tub than they are today in the tropics, temperatures of around 95 degrees Fahrenheit.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
In as little as 80 years from now, Earth may begin to resemble the greenhouse world of the early Cenozoic era, nearly 50 million years ago. During that time, global climate was several degrees warmer thanks to the higher CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. Tropical oceans became hot tubs, sea levels rose 50 meters, and the poles reached above freezing temperatures. So what does this all mean for the future of marine ecosystems? Linda Poon spoke with Richard Norris on how lessons from Earth's geological past can help us diagnose the future of not only our climate, but also the marine environment and its organisms.
So what we found is that in the geologic past, there are examples of how the world looked when it had much higher greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere, and that act as possible analogs for what we might expect to happen in the future. We also discovered that during that past greenhouse time, the world was at least several degrees warmer than it is today, that we didn't have major polar ice sheets, that we didn't have reefs as we know them today. And very importantly, I think that the food chains were different in the past than they are now. They supported typically much smaller algae in the open ocean, which in turn supported fewer really large animals than we have today.
So you distinguish between mean climate states and transient states. So what are the differences between the two, and how do they help us understand past and future marine ecosystems?
So mean climate states are the kind of conditions that exist over millions of years at some point in geologic history. We particularly think about the greenhouse world as being a mean climate state. It's a time when the atmospheric CO2 concentration was much higher than today. But those conditions existed for millions of years, and so the whole ecosystem was kind of in equilibrium with a very high CO2 concentration in the atmosphere. A transient climate state is more like what we're going to do, or we are in the middle of doing right now, to planet Earth. That is a very rapid transition from relatively cool climates into relatively warm climates. And it turns out we have examples of those in the geologic past as well. The reason why we're interested in looking at these very rapid warming events is because many parts of the Earth ecosystem don't respond at the same rates. So some things like surface heating, that happens very quickly. As soon as you add greenhouse gases, the planet warms up. But other things like melting big ice sheets, that takes probably tens of thousands of years to go to completion. It takes probably at least a few thousand years for CO2 to be completely absorbed by the ocean. And it takes many thousands of years for many ecosystems to come to equilibrium with their new conditions. So it's very important that we study transient climate events because they give us a sense of how dynamic the system is that we're going to be producing, or that we are in the middle of producing, with modern global change. Mm-hmm. But it's useful also to have these mean climate state observations to have a sense of how the world worked when it kind of had come to equilibrium with much higher greenhouse gas concentrations.
Mm-hmm. So your study suggests that the marine system will look fairly similar to the greenhouse world of the early Cenozoic era, which was about 50 million years ago. So what were the climate and oceans like then, and what impact did it have on the marine ecosystem?
I think the first thing to observe is that the oceans were much warmer than they are now. So back in the greenhouse world, we had surface water temperatures that were closer to a hot tub than they are today in the tropics, temperatures of around 95 degrees Fahrenheit, 35 degrees centigrade. And the poles were also considerably warmer than they are today, more like 12 degrees centigrade, mid-50 Fahrenheit. And therefore, they didn't support big polar ice sheets back then as they do today. Another thing that's important is that the ocean, because it was warmer in part, it also had less oxygen stored in it. And so the ocean wasn't quite as well oxygenated. This is something we actually observe today as we burn fossil fuels. We also observed that sea level was much higher, about 50 meters higher than it is today. That would be plenty to flood all of Florida and the Gulf coastal states and the mid-Atlantic states up to the Appalachians. And ecologically, it's interesting that we see that reef ecosystems, despite the fact that there was a lot of shallow water habitat available, that reefs didn't really like the warm greenhouse world very much. We find very few coral algal reefs during about a 15-million-year period at the peak of greenhouse warming. We also observe this phenomenon that we can actually observe the beginnings of today, in which in the tropical and subtropical oceans, the food chains become much longer than they are now. So you get smaller algae at the base of the food chain. These are bacteria and so-called picoplankton, very, very tiny cells. And they just basically don't contain enough energy to be able to support large animals at the top of the food chain. Modern groups that we know and love, like large whales and seals and some of the big seabird radiations, the radiations of things like tunas, all of these major diversification events are a cold climate phenomenon. They've happened since the greenhouse world died away and transitioned into the modern ice house.
So the future won't look exactly the same. It's not going to go exactly back to what it was like 50 million years ago. So what will be different?
The ancient greenhouse is quite different from the modern in a couple of respects. One is that back 50 million years ago, we didn't have a circum-Antarctic current system because the various tectonic passageways between Antarctica and Australia and Antarctica and South America were not open. But today we have that, and that allows for extensive wind-driven mixing in the Southern Ocean, which sustains these relatively short food chains based in diatoms. And it's unlikely that that kind of ecosystem will disappear completely, because that's a tectonic phenomenon rather than strictly a climate phenomenon. The other thing which I think is very striking about the near future is that as long as we maintain big ice sheets on the poles, the poles will remain relatively cool compared to what they were in the greenhouse world. And that, in turn, will keep the deep ocean much colder in the future than it was in the greenhouse time.
Mm-hmm. So you say the greenhouse world isn't a perfect analog for it, and maybe a closer analogy might be the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. So what lessons can we draw from that?
Yeah, so the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum is one of a series of intense, relatively short global warming events in the geologic past. And CO2 was introduced into the atmosphere very quickly, and that more closely sort of mimics what we're doing to the planet now, where we are going to be driving the greenhouse gas concentrations up to 50 million year sort of levels in about 80 years. And so that produces some effects which we don't see in the classic greenhouse world. For one thing, so much CO2 is added quickly to the surface ocean that it creates what we call ocean acidification, which is basically just the buildup of acids in the surface waters before they get completely mixed throughout the whole ocean and diluted. And we have kind of controversial evidence as to whether acidification happened in the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. I'd say that the odds are that there probably was some acidification, but whether it's as severe as is projected for the future is not clear at this point. We also see that when you warm up the surface ocean very quickly, the ocean becomes stratified, so it's very warm on top and relatively cool below, and that reduces the ability of the oceans to mix and causes the subsurface waters to be driven into low oxygen states, and is something that we project to happen in the future if we, you know, burn up substantial reservoirs of fossil fuels. The remarkable thing is that the Paleocene-Eocene event did not involve major extinctions. Species move around substantially. There are major ecological disruptions, but it doesn't involve, you know, the doom and gloom, the end of time kind of thing.
So the way you compare this was using models, and whenever you're predicting the future, there's often a lot of data crunching and a lot of models involved. So how reliable is the model that you use in your research?
Right. I think that oftentimes models are somewhat controversial because, you know, we wonder whether they had complete dynamics or not. One of the great advantages of looking in the geologic past is that we're looking at a complete ecosystem, one that operated in broad brush terms similar to today or towards the near future. And that is, in fact, the case. So our future models show lots of dynamics that we actually see examples of during the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. So I wouldn't swear that the future models are, you know, 100% accurate, but I think that they give us a guideline that is probably accurate about the likely duration of major ecological changes and some of the major kinds of dynamics that are likely to play out.
So all this might be happening within our kids' lifetime, so that's not too far from now. Are there steps that we can take to mitigate the consequences of our impact, or is it already irreversible?
I think this is a very interesting question, because something that was a surprise to me was that we did two different simulations of the future. Mm-hmm. One of them was that we just said, okay, as much CO2 as we've added to the atmosphere, that we're going to stop that right now. And it turns out that the ecological effects of the CO2 that we've already added to the atmosphere will be recognizable for the next roughly 1,000 years, according to our model. Temperature that is produced by the current sort of spike of greenhouse gas addition to the atmosphere will die out over that kind of time period. But it turns out that if we wait just 80 years before we take control of the global change phenomenon, then the sort of very strong ecological impacts last more like 20,000 years, so substantially longer. And the human sort of fingerprint of global change lasts something in excess of 100,000 years. This turns out to be quite similar to what we observe in the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum. And so it seems to me this is a clarion call, you know, to do something about greenhouse gases, because the implications of waiting just a relatively short period of time are quite substantial.
Well, Richard Norris, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're most welcome.
Richard Norris and colleagues write about future oceanic environmental changes in this week's special issue.
Our understanding of the many roles of RNA in the body has substantially expanded in the past few years. As part of our series on science policy and commentary, Science's Nisha Gurridharan spoke with Eric Miska about new potential roles for these amazing molecules outside of the body.
I thought social RNA would be a good way to convey what we are trying to find in the lab, namely RNA that communicates between organisms and possibly also between different species.
You can find Miska's interview and his perspective in the current issue at www.sciencemag.org.
Climate change may be a new event for modern humans, but it's not a novel phenomenon on Earth. By looking at past biological responses to climate change, scientists are hoping to anticipate how our own ecosystem will respond to rapid rise in warming, a shift in climate that is unprecedented since the end of the last glacial period. I spoke with Jessica Blois about identifying patterns in a timeline that spans millions of years and what clues have emerged so far.
We wanted to understand whether climate change alters the way in which species interact with one another, and not just looking at species and communities today, but also in the past, over thousands of years and over millions of years. We found at all time scales that climate change can alter biotic interactions in highly complex ways. So if we don't incorporate biotic interactions when we're anticipating future changes in our ecological systems, we're missing a big piece of the puzzle.
Since your work focuses so heavily on biotic interactions, how are you using that term here?
That's a really good question. The term biotic interactions means different things to different disciplines or to different people within those disciplines. It broadly encapsulates relationships like competition, predation, facilitations, or mutualisms. But many of these relationships between species aren't easy to capture in the fossil record, or even in modern systems for that matter. So here in our work, we're referring to biotic interactions in the broadest sense of the word, simply as the influence of individuals or populations on one another.
And so then, what are some of the hurdles to predicting the effects of climate change on biological systems?
One of the biggest hurdles is, in some ways, we want it all. We want to know what's going to happen in the future for all species and for all systems, but we can't have it all. You know, no system or no timescale is perfect. And when we try to predict the effects into the future, we don't know exactly the way that climate change is going to play out across space and through time. And so, you know, the fossil record allows us to study ecosystems across timescales, on both ecological timescales and on geological timescales, but it's unevenly distributed across time and across environments and taxa, and in terms of biotic interactions, it's really only capturing fragmentary information on biotic interactions. So it's hard to just use the fossil record alone to predict the effects of climate change on biotic interactions in the future. Modern systems are nice because they provide direct and observational evidence. You can do experiments in modern systems. You can get, you know, dig down into mechanism and try to figure out what's really driving changes in biotic interactions as climate changes. But it's not always clear how you take those, you know, experiments or mechanistic insights and extrapolate them to longer timescales.
So what then are some reoccurring themes that have been extracted from the fossil record?
One of the things that we often see are the appearance of these novel but transitory assemblages of species. So suites of species or groups of species that haven't co-occurred in the past but do at a particular point in time. And often the appearance of these novel assemblages is due to climate change. And they're often characterized by generalist taxa. So, for example, after mass extinction events, you often get the establishment of these assemblages dominated by very weedy or generalist species with broad environmental ranges. And over time, those assemblages might be replaced by more specialized assemblages. But immediately after major perturbation, you get very generalist assemblages. And so we see this in the deep time over millions of years, and we also see this 15,000 years ago, we get the appearance of these novel assemblages in response to climate change and loss of megafaunal species. And so this is something that I think is interesting to note and to be worried about for the future, because it's hard to predict which of the species are going to be present in these assemblages and how long these assemblages are going to persist.
Right. And transitioning to the here and now, what conclusions mm-hmm. can we draw from observations of present-day changes in biotic interactions?
Well, there's so much work being done in this area that I think it's a really exciting time. It's also hard to sort through everything because there's so much work, and I think that what a lot of the studies in the here and now show is that the impact of climate on biotic interactions is complex. And so it's really hard to draw, you know, robust inferences about broad suites of species. But one of the interesting things is I think because, you know, we can get to mechanism in studies taking place, you know, today or in the past few years or decades, is that changes in phenology or the timing of life history events seem to be especially likely to alter interactions between species. For example, there's been some recent work in the Arctic showing that the timing of caribou calving and peak foraging times in the tundra are coupled, and this is work done by Eric Post and colleagues. But recent climate change is shifting the peak of the tundra forage season earlier, yet the timing of the calving hasn't kept pace.
So humans have already influenced more than 80% of the Earth's land surface. Looking at the past for biotic patterns is a good start, but how does human development complicate these predictions?
Well, human development is definitely an enormous challenge for our ecological systems, as well as for how well we can make predictions about the future. And so it's not just human development, it's many other kinds of human impacts, like invasive species, you know, hunting, and then the sort of direct development impacts that lead to habitat fragmentation and loss. So all of these impacts are essentially disrupting the natural functioning of our ecological systems. And so I view the work that we've done here, and indeed a lot of the work that I do, other areas of my research, is trying to establish baselines of how our systems function naturally as best as we can tell. And we can use the past and the changes that we see in the absence of humans as a guidepost for what kind of changes we might expect for the future, and also potentially ways that we might devise management actions. So, for example, we know from a lot of the work on both past and more recent climate change that one of the natural responses that species have to climate is to shift their geographic distributions. And today, it's difficult for species and communities to do that naturally. You know, we've put up roads, we've removed habitat corridors, we've put in housing developments right in the place that they might need to go. Coupled with this, climate change of the future is going to be happening potentially faster than species' sort of native capacity to migrate, to shift their distributions. And so we think that the natural baseline response that species have to climate change might not work. And so this could potentially lead to some innovative management solutions such as managed relocation, where if species aren't able to use their natural responses to shift, we perhaps can look to innovative management solutions such as managed relocation, where we help or assist species in their movement.
And so then, what other areas of research do you think are promising for predicting future effects of climate change?
You know, whenever possible, we need to try to combine the strengths of research in different systems. So, you know, there's a lot of strengths in research in the here and now, but the past also has a lot to tell us. And so can we try to tie together those strengths to gain greater insights? And so for me, the most exciting opportunity is using the recent past as a bridge between the ecological timescales that we see in the present and the evolutionary timescales we see in the deeper time to try to gain insight about the future.
All right. Well, Jessica Blois, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Jessica Blois and colleagues write about the influence of biotic interactions on ecosystem responses to climate change in this week's special issue of Science.
We and our pathogens have a complicated relationship, and climate change isn't making things any easier. As part of our special issue on natural systems in changing climates, Sonja Altizer and colleagues wrote a review about how changing temperatures can change the range and life cycles of infectious diseases, their vectors, and their victims. I spoke with her about the difficulty of these kinds of studies and what could be done if pathogen ranges do shift.
Well, the main message that we wanted to get across is that a lot of diseases, especially in natural systems, have already increased in response to climate change, and we think that this trend will continue. But sometimes climate change has the opposite effect of reducing disease or might have no effect at all, and so knowing why different pathogens respond differently to climate change is really important to help predict and maybe even mitigate or deal with disease outbreaks in people, animals, and plants. And the cutting edge right now is to look at how organisms, how hosts and pathogens and vectors respond physiologically to specific climate variables, you know, starting with temperature, and then link that mechanistically to population-level outcomes. So it's these mechanisms and the variation in outcomes that we really want to focus attention on.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about those mechanisms. How does this work? What are some of the mechanisms by which climate change can influence the spread of disease?
Well, backing up a little bit, the parasites that we think of as being most sensitive to climate change are generally ones that have environmental stages that persist outside of the host, and parasites that infect ectothermic or cold-blooded hosts or insect vectors that themselves are more vulnerable or sensitive to outside temperatures. And in some cases, warmer temperatures can speed up the development of those parasites so that their life cycles are shorter and they transmit faster. And warmer temperatures could also expand the window of time each year that the pathogens remain active. Now, in other cases, warm temperatures could change the timing of vector life stages and feeding behavior. For example, mild winters not only would reduce the overwintering mortality of ticks that are important vectors for disease, but they can also result in different tick stages, especially larval and nymphal ticks, feeding at the same time during the spring. And that synchronous feeding is known to speed up the transmission of Lyme disease. And then we also talk about mechanisms where climate can affect the behavior, diversity, or immune defenses of the host. And one example that we talk about is some nice work showing that greater climate variation can actually lower the immune defenses of some amphibians and insects. And another example we talk about is the fact that animal migrations are shifting in response to climate change, and in some cases are disappearing altogether. And there's evidence that these migrations can help protect some animals from disease by allowing them to escape periodically from areas with lots of parasites. It's important to point out that most of the cases we talk about in the paper show evidence for warmer temperatures enhancing disease spread. Mm-hmm. But there are also cases where hotter temperatures could have the opposite effect. For example, by increasing the mortality of pathogens in the environment or the mortality rates of vectors. And we also pointed out that there are other variables that could change too, like rainfall and humidity. And these could change the risk of disease, although a lot less is known about variables other than temperature.
Right. Well, one of the terms you use in the paper is climate signal. Can you talk about what that means and why it's been so hard to detect in certain settings?
So by climate signal, we mean how closely changes in disease outcomes, so things like the prevalence or intensity or severity of infection or the range of area that a disease occupies, how closely that tracks changes in climate. And this can be really hard to detect for a number of reasons. For humans, perhaps the biggest challenge is that a lot of places that would be prone to disease expansions with climate change are at higher latitudes. And these places also are areas where we have better infrastructure and healthcare and disease control. And so these mechanisms that humans have to counter disease risk can actually mask climate signals because we're pretty good at keeping disease out with better surveillance, vector control, modern sanitation, and antimicrobial drugs. All of these things could prevent disease outbreaks from happening, mm-hmm. especially for vector-borne diseases or diarrheal diseases in the developed world. And so we might actually be heading off these diseases at the pass. For natural systems, there's a different challenge because pathogen responses to climate change are happening in this much bigger arena of other types of global change. So habitat loss, biodiversity loss, pollution, all of these can affect natural ecosystems. And so picking up this signal of disease responses to shifts in climate relative to all these other things that are happening is really challenging.
Well, so as you kind of indicated already, this isn't just about human diseases. We're talking about crops, corals, caribou. Can you give some examples of how different organisms and their diseases have shifted with climate?
Well, some of the systems where disease responses to warming are causing the biggest impacts are in the Arctic and in the Caribbean. So in the Arctic, lungworm parasites of muskox are developing faster. They're becoming more prevalent and expanding their geographic range. And this has coincided with declines of wildlife, including muskox, in some areas.
And what about in the Caribbean?
So in tropical waters like Caribbean coral reefs, warming can actually interfere with the symbiosis of corals and their solar-powered algae, making the corals more vulnerable to disease. And at the same time, speeding up the growth of pathogens, like some lethal bacteria. And so this disease and heat stress together in coral reef ecosystems in the Caribbean have essentially put an entire ecosystem at risk of extinction.
Well, let's move to human diseases. Can we tell which ones are going to change with the climate and in what ways?
So for human diseases that might respond to climate warming, generally we're thinking about things like diarrheal disease, vector-borne disease, parasitic diseases like some worms, and maybe zoonotic disease. There might be some cases where, because of ways that wildlife disease are responding to climate and ways that pathogens are spilling over to humans, that you could have sort of linkages between the two. But generally, we're thinking, I think, first and foremost about vector-borne disease. And as one example, tick-borne diseases could expand upwards into higher latitudes and altitudes, and that's partly because the winter mortality of ticks goes down with warmer winters. And we could also see mosquito-borne diseases like malaria, dengue, and viruses like chikungunya virus expanding into higher latitudes. On the other hand, some tropical areas could see less infection because in places where it's already warm, the temperatures could exceed the optimal range for mosquitoes or other biting vectors or the pathogen. And then for diarrheal diseases, cholera outbreaks, as one example, tend to correlate with sea surface temperatures. So when sea surface temperatures are warmer, areas might be more prone to cholera outbreaks. So this could increase with climate change. A point that we wanted to make in the paper is that predicting how infectious disease, including human disease, will respond to climate warming really depends on where the pathogen is at any given point within what we'd call its thermal envelope. So places that are currently at the warm limit of a pathogen's range will probably see less disease, whereas geographic locations that are currently cooler relative to the pathogen's upper limit are probably going to see more disease.
What's the value of being able to make predictions about these shifts in infectious diseases? Are we going to be able to react if we can do a good job predicting these things?
So the value of making these predictions is a really interesting question. And we know that forecasting in crop disease systems can improve the timing of control measures. So, for example, applying fungicides at the optimal time before outbreaks occur to try to prevent crop disease, or even changing planning strategies in advance of a high projected disease year. For human diseases, the responses to predicted high risks include a variety of activities such as heightened surveillance, maybe more intense vector control efforts, having vaccines or antimicrobial drugs on hand for deployment, knowing which infections are likely to change with climate shifts could also help allocate control efforts towards the specific pathogens and locations where they're most needed.
Okay. So there are a lot of examples in this work of the challenges to making predictions about these changes. And to me, it's just the complexity we're working on an ecosystem level here. So what are the next steps to actually getting the patterns nailed down better and being able to make these predictions?
So our focus in the paper in terms of what the next steps are is especially to emphasize the need for a deeper understanding of these mechanistic drivers. So for example, ecologists have made a lot of progress in using information on metabolism and physiology of organisms to understand how the distribution or abundance of species is dictated by the environment. And some recent work has brought parasites into this framework. So most of this work has not considered parasitic organisms, but recently that's changing. And this has a lot of potential for predicting how different types of diseases will respond to climate warming. And as you might expect, it takes a lot of work to nail down the mechanistic drivers, especially experimental work that looks at how the growth, development, and survival or transmission of parasites varies across a temperature gradient. And to try to push things forward at a more rapid pace, there's some recent approaches from what's called metabolic ecology theory that have the potential to give scenarios without having to collect all of the meticulous data up front. So this mathematical theory can generate ideas and predictions, and then experimental approaches could generate data to test these ideas, and there can be a back and forth between the theory and data. And then another big challenge, and this probably sounds like a broken record that's played over and over again, but we need to collect and analyze more long-term data sets on parasitism and disease to try to look for that climate signal. And building archives of collections of samples, these really are the only way that will be able to track future changes over time. And especially in a lot of natural ecosystems, these baseline infection data are missing.
All right. Well, Sonja Altizer, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Sonja Altizer and colleagues write about climate change and infectious disease as part of this week's special issue on natural systems in changing climates. You can read her work and more at www.sciencemag.org/special/climate2013.
Although murky salt marshes are not the most glamorous of ecosystems, the United Nations considers them one of the world's most valuable biomes. However, as climate change causes sea levels to rise, marshes are in danger of drowning. I spoke with Eli Kintish about this danger and what can be done to protect these wetland ecosystems.
Sea level rise is affecting coastal ecosystems all around the world. Scientists are trying to understand how these very resilient ecosystems, which have evolved to withstand storms and tidal changes and eons of glacial retreat and glacial advance, how these ecosystems can and might react in the future under scenarios of accelerated sea level rise. There's some debate right now over what's happening with marshes. As sea level rises on the East Coast, it's happening around 3 millimeters a year. And in other places, that global sea level rise is augmented where marshes are on land that's either sinking or they're losing the sediment which feeds them.
Since these ecosystems are sinking, can you explain why these marshes are important to preserve?
Wetlands provide an incredible amount of biodiversity for ocean ecosystems. They lock up as much as 250 million tons of carbon every year, and they protect human settlements and natural ecosystems from storms by buffering the coastlines from waves and from wind, and they filter water. They sort of are the bottom layer of many ocean ecosystems, so they're linked to food production all around the world.
What is happening with Louisiana's Mississippi Delta? I know that researchers are sort of looking into that area. Can you elaborate a little further?
Land is sinking in Louisiana at the same time as you have this global sea level rise. So there, it's kind of like a snapshot of what might happen in the future under accelerated global sea level in places where the land isn't sinking. The problems with the wetlands in Louisiana are made worse by the fact that marshes require sediment, essentially like mud and silt, which they trap and they use to build up and to react to rising seas. But because of efforts to essentially control the seas and the relationship with the water and to prevent flooding, levees have been built, and those levees block off sources of sediment from providing this rich soil, essentially, for marshes. The effect of all this is that the marshes are disappearing in Louisiana. They're being drowned.
So then what makes one marsh more adaptable and likely to survive harsh climate conditions over another? Is the sediment the important aspect?
Marshes can react to rising sea levels in a couple of different ways. First, they can build up through organic matter. Their own biodegraded grass and litter can help provide a kind of organic fuel for the soil to help the marshes grow higher. The second way is that the sediment that comes down rivers is deposited in these marshes and helps them build up as the water rises, over time. The third thing they can do is they can move inland, actually migrate. This happens essentially naturally. It's not like these grasses have brains and they can decide what to do. These are just kind of natural processes that allow the grasses to live, but they can move inland. Finally, if they fail to either build up or move inland, as the sea level rises, they can die, which is happening all around the world.
And are things like land development impediments for marshes moving inland?
Yes, so development all around the world is really affecting the source of crucial sediment. Rivers are being dammed, and when people build homes, they often put a wall by the edge of their property along a river or a delta or a bay to prevent erosion. they're essentially trying to prevent their lawn from becoming a marsh. There was a study that showed that as much as two-thirds of Europe and parts of Asia have shorelines that have been armored or protected. They view it as stopping erosion or protecting their shores from sea level, but it's actually stopping the sediment from going out to the marshes in the other direction.
Is there agreement about the impact of climate change on marsh ecosystems? As a community, where do wetland scientists stand as a whole?
Well, there's certainly agreement that if the accelerated scenarios of global sea level rise were to happen, then marshes would be in big trouble all around the world. You know, globally, sea level is rising somewhere between 1 to 4 millimeters a year, but that could accelerate all the way to a centimeter or more a year if ice caps were to start melting in an accelerated fashion. In that scenario, scientists are all agreed that the marshes are in big trouble. Where the scientists are at odds is what the exact mechanism is of different marshes in different places and what their fate would be.
So I know that right now there is talk of creating a global network of forecasting devices. Can you explain this idea a bit further?
It's a little shocking how little we know about the kind of current state of marshes around the world. We simply don't take data about the height of marshes in many places outside of kind of the most focused on marsh ecosystems like the Gulf of Mexico and a couple long-term ecological sanctuaries where scientists have watched marshes, and they've developed a very simple device which basically sits on the bedrock or above the ground below a marsh and has little sticks that go up and simply mark where the marsh was at a certain time. And by returning back to these height markers, can show you whether the marsh is rising, falling, or staying at the same height. And so it's shocking when you learn how simple these markers are to install and how cheap they are that we don't have them all around the world. On paper, the marshes must be in trouble because of, you know, the sea level rise and the fear of acceleration. Mm-hmm. But we don't actually have hard data on where they're in the most trouble.
All right, then. Well, Eli Kintish, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Christy.
Eli Kintish writes about the impact of rising sea level on wetland ecosystems in this week's special issue of Science.
And that concludes the August 2nd, 2013 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi.
And I'm Christy Hamilton. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.